So, welcome back, Daniel.
Welcome back to you, Jeremy.
Thank you. Of course, if you're listening, then you know this is the final five of the 10 greatest freshman films of all time, as decided by Daniel and myself. Now, if you haven't listened to part one, you're going to be tempted to just skip to the end even of this episode.
Because who isn't, right? I mean,
well, of course.
When you look at lists, you scroll to the bottom, you see there are four pages. You want to get to that fourth page to see what really is like the top five.
Yeah.
Don't do that with this.
No. You want the full experience. I mean, if you listen to the Freshman 15 podcast, you listen to hear a couple of idiots drone on and on and on about films. And you know what, man? That's what we're doing.
That's what this is.
That's
what we are. And that's all right. We're having a great time.
You know, though, before we get into our final five picks, which I couldn't be more excited about because I don't know what you're going to say. You don't know what I'm going to say. There's a certain amount of guilt about what didn't make it.
Right.
And I feel like before we get into this final list of our top five films, I want to at least mention there's some great films that didn't make my list and didn't make your list.
There has to be, right? In every great list.
I look at my list. There are things that I just so badly wanted to be on there.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's just some great films that I think a lot of people don't realize our freshman films. I really wanted to see Pee-wee's Big Adventure on the list.
Well, yeah, of course.
It's a great film. People don't know that was a freshman film. Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a freshman film that, you know, for the ages.
Yeah.
It was great. I'll also admit, Mission Impossible 3. I love that movie.
You love that movie.
It was a freshman film, and it has one of the greatest intros of all time, and I wanted to wedge that thing into my list, but I couldn't do it.
I mean, I wanted Heart 8 to be on there. I mean, for PTA, he's my guy.
Yeah.
And to not have him on my top 10, it hurt a little bit.
Yeah. Heart 8 was a great film.
Right.
But I was even, in order to make my own list, sometimes I went back through directors and I was like, okay, wait, what was their first? And then I would look and sometimes their first film was the only film of theirs that I didn't like.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have that conundrum.
I also wanted Shotgun Stories, Jeff Nichols.
Sure.
I love the guy. You know, and then there were some films I wish were freshman films.
Sure.
I mean, Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead.
Shaun of the Dead. In fact, if we ever do an Edgar Wright episode, I think that we need to just officially declare that as his freshman film since he refuses to release his actual freshman
film. I mean, I was so bummed. I actually was thinking, oh, yeah, this is going to make it on the list. And then I went to go check it and I'm like, oh, damn it.
Yeah. I suspect that even in our top five, we're going to have one or two overlap.
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll have at least one.
But I'll tell you, the thing that's delighted me is the fact that we've thus far had exactly one overlap film, and I kind of anticipated more, but I'm liking this diversity.
I thought we'd have more as well. But I'm so happy with the picks that we've named.
Yeah. So we're getting into our top five here. And of course, this is kind of outrage territory potentially, because how could you pick this and not pick that? I mean, you know, it's inevitable.
I'm a little stressed.
People that listen to these kinds of lists, you know, you're going to make somebody unhappy. That's just the way it goes. But nevertheless.
Here we go.
So, Daniel, my number five pick. I bent the rules a little on this one, but, you know, we never really necessarily established the rules, so I thought, well, hey, while I decided to leave out things like foreign films, which you clearly included, I decided to actually include on my list documentaries. My favorite documentary of all time happens to be a freshman film from 2003. It's a film by director Andrew Jarecki, and that film is Capturing the Freedmans.
It would be on this list.
You felt it.
I felt it. Incredible film.
Incredible film. If you've never seen Capturing the Freedmans, it's a transformative experience. It certainly was for me. Well, in a way, it's almost more helpful to talk about the story behind the film than to talk about the film itself. Mm-hmm. Andrew Jarecki decided to chuck it all to make documentary films, and he decided to start with a film about clowns. And over the course of filming the story about a fairly well-known clown, he came to find out that this clown, whose real name was David Friedman, actually had quite a dark past and history. And he also came to find out that his family was involved in very famous child molestation case from the 1980s. Behind the scenes, David Friedman had taken home movies of all the private conversations, of the court cases, and all these things, just absolutely found gold for any documentarian. Andrew Jarecki changed the direction of what he wanted his clown documentary to be about. And he said, no, I know something good when I see it. I want the story to be about this. So Capturing the Freedmans is, of course, the story of this father and his sons, the Freedman family, accused and jailed for child molestation. And I won't reveal who in the family was and wasn't and what happened, what didn't happen, because the twists and turns in this movie are just absolutely astonishing.
So astonishing.
So astonishing. Like, you're absolutely on the edge of your seat minute by minute. Like, how could this be? How could that be? How could this be? The personalities are so big and so memorable. The legal representation to the law enforcement, to the people in the family themselves. It's just like, it's a story couldn't be made up that's more compelling and ridiculous as this story. My reaction to the film was to actually, when it was done, I contacted Jesse Freedman myself and had an exchange with him about some of the truths, maybe hidden, maybe underneath the movie. I was that affected by it, but man, what an experience.
It's hard to describe. You actually just need to watch the film. And I think the one thing I love about the story behind the film and what I love about Jarecki is really, I think, the courage it took to kind of just go for it. You get the sense that he's wanting to tell this story because it needs to be told.
It forces you to ask the question, how committed to truth are you really? Because there are things that seem true. There are things that are easy to believe. There are truths that seem to represent themselves almost in a way, but are they actually true? And the film keeps going down this road again and again and again. How committed to truth are we really versus how committed are we to this narrative that just feels right to us? We're heading into a very tumultuous year in many ways. I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
The question of what is true and what can be taken as truth and what is truth at all is never more pertinent than right now. So I would say that a film like Capturing the Freedmans has never been more timely.
Maybe I shot the videotape so that I wouldn't have to remember it myself. Like when your parents take pictures of you, do you remember the being there or do you remember just the photograph hanging on the wall?
It's almost surreal. I don't think any of us had any notion of what was going on or what we were doing or where any of this was leading.
He told us, nothing happened. That's good enough for me. Nothing happened.
This is an interesting coincidence, not because we have the same pick, but we certainly have the same genre. My number five is also a documentary film.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't expect that.
One of these films that I watched later in life, but have continued to watch it, and it's the 1978 film, Gates of Heaven, by Earl Morris.
Earl Morris. The king. Honestly, I don't think there's a better documentarian born.
I don't think so either. And this film blows me away.
It's
every freaking time I watch it. It is astonishing because what he does by simply putting a camera in front of people and letting them disclose themselves is unbelievable.
Yeah.
You can watch this film as many times as you want to watch it, and you will have the same questions every time. Is he making fun of these people?
Yeah.
Wait, is this serious? Is this satire? Is this, what am I watching? And I love that. And actually, I think it points to, he's really gracious and generous of his subjects.
Yeah.
That grace and that generosity might lead these characters to say some pretty terrible things about themselves or disclose some things that they probably shouldn't. I don't know. It's so good. So the story of Gates of Heaven, it's about pet cemeteries. It's really cut in half by these two different stories. One is this kind of failed pet cemetery and the other one is this successful pet cemetery that actually still exists. I mean, it has questions about what is a pet? What does it mean for a pet to die? What's the relationship between a pet owner and their pet? What's the afterlife for pets? I mean, so many questions that you think you wouldn't necessarily care about, but you do.
Yeah.
And you do because of the people in the film who care about these questions.
Sure. You can't tell me that Errol Morris doesn't have affection for the people that are sitting in front of his camera. It's obvious that he loves these people.
I mean, it's poetry. I love it. I love the movie.
Skippy had been dead quite a while, 2 or 3 years. You know. Yeah. I don't want to think about it. He was so... Everybody liked that dog around here. You know, you miss your pets just like you do any of the family. And I don't know what happened to this last little kitty was here. All the cats have gone. There's no cats around her, no animals, no nothing. I miss that little black kitten so much. It was wonderful. All of a sudden, boom, no animals around.
It's a perennial. To me, it's kind of like it's half of a set. You watch Gates of Heaven immediately after, put in Vernon, Florida.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they should be watched together. This is the early Errol Morris experience. He's done these towering documentaries about powerful political figures and strange documentaries about tabloid, you know, which is just the most gonzo bananas story you'll ever hear in your life.
True.
The Stephen Hawking documentary, which is absolutely compelling material. He manages to find the most interesting pieces and put them together in every single one of his documentaries. It's an event in our house when a new Errol Morris documentary is out because the man is just, he's unsurpassed.
Oh, he's an unbelievable.
I love it. Documentary, number five, two documentaries.
I never would have guessed.
I wouldn't have guessed that either. So Daniel, number four. And I'm going to hit you with the least surprising pick of the evening.
All right.
The 1996 film that you know I have nothing but total and complete love for. And that is the Wes Anderson film, Bottle Rocket.
Okay.
Man.
It's got to be there.
It's got to be on the list. I mentioned during our Bottle Rocket episode, of all the Freshman 15 episodes we've done so far, Bottle Rocket is my favorite on the list. And that still stands. I know we've got several episodes left, but it's going to be real hard to surpass Bottle Rocket. Man, the film's so good.
The film's so good.
Pointless act! You don't give a $500 tip to the housekeeper! That's inappropriate! That's inexcusable! That I don't forgive! What were you thinking? What were you thinking? That's what she is!
Don't call her the housekeeper.
Don't threaten me. That's what she is. She is a housekeeper, right? People are housekeepers.
You better watch it, Dignan. You don't know what you're talking about right now. Her name's Inez.
And my name's Dignan, man. So what? She didn't love you, man.
See the film. If you haven't seen Bottle Rocket, go watch Bottle Rocket. What are you waiting for?
So I'll wait till my number three to talk about Bottle Rocket.
All right, spoiler.
And I'll talk about my number four film, which is the 1973 freshman film of Terrence Malick, Badlands.
Badlands.
Badlands was one of those films that I knew immediately was going to be on here. I just didn't know where it was going to land.
Yeah, this is high on the list, Badlands.
It's high. The things I love about Terrence Malick films, or at least I'd say Tree of Life, and four. The things I love about those films are, of course, his filmmaking style. I love the transcendence that I kind of feel like his films are after. I love the questions that they ask. I love how absorbed I am in the environment that the film sort of creates. But Badlands, I think, is interesting in that it's really one of his smallest films in terms of characters and who he seems to focus on. Badlands is really a story of this man named Kit and this woman, Holly, and it's their relationship kind of held together by this murder spree that they kind of go on through the Badlands, through this area in North America. And some of the things that gets me going is how detached the characters seem to be from what it is they're actually doing. And you right away, you know it's a Terrence Malick film. And I saw this after his other film, so I kind of knew what to expect. But you have this narration. But never has a narration in a Terrence Malick film seemed so disconnected from what you're actually seeing. In that Holly's narration, you're like, you aren't actually talking about what these things are you're doing. You can tell she's like an unreliable narrator. She's not able to actually see what they're capable of.
Right.
And nor is she able to see that their relationship is purely connected and supported by the taking of life.
One day, while taking a look at some vistas in Dad's stereopticon, it hit me that I was just this little girl, born in Texas, whose father was a sign painter, who had only just so many years to live. It sent a chill down my spine, and I thought, where would I be this very moment if Kit had never met me or killed anybody? This very moment. If my mom had never met my dad, if she'd have never died, and what's the man I'll marry going to look like?
But I think that's a very American story, actually. Kit and Holly and maybe one other character are the only people with names. All these other characters are simply roles in their story. So this is their story.
Even in the credits, you mean? And
yeah, I mean, it's like father and sheriff. And so it's just a fascinating idea that this is their story, which was actually based on some true events.
Yeah.
What's their motive? Why are they doing this? The questions that aren't ever answered. And really, are there answers that would be sufficient for something like that?
Confession time. I've never given my full attention to Badlands.
Okay.
I enjoy Terrence Malick, but for me, that's more of a recent affection, actually.
Oh.
Malick movies, I've always been like, yeah, I see. But it's only been since Tree of Life that I've been like, I need to really concentrate here. We just finished our Paul Thomas Anderson episode. And, you know, one of the themes of that was, here's an artist that deserves attention that you might be tempted to not give your full attention, but man, you have to, because it's going to be rewarded. You can't sort of sideways glance at Terrence Malick. It's just not going to work out for you.
Yeah, it requires your attention for sure.
I'll tell you, so Daniel, final three for me, and I can't speak for both of us here, but final three aren't just like, oh, these are my favorite freshman films. We're now in the territory of, these are some of my favorite films.
Right.
If I were making a list of just the greatest films that I think that there are, these would be on it. And I can't overstate my affection of everything else that's left on my list. It's just a, you know, it's just a big deal.
Ooh, I can't wait.
So number three, it's a film that I've always loved for its simplicity. People don't realize that this is a freshman film because it's quite a famous film. The film in question is from 1957. It's from auteur-director Sidney Lumet. And of course, the film is 12 Angry Men.
Yep.
I can't get enough of 12 Angry Men. It's just everything about it is just sheer perfection. It's just...
It's brilliant.
Powerful, compelling, amazing. When you know the story of how the film was made, it was practically a written-for-TV script. Sidney Lumet was a work-for-hire television director. And just the whole thing was just kind of thrown together. And somehow, some of the greatest actors of the day, one of the greatest scripts, in my opinion, ever written for the screen, the entire thing taking place in this one tiny room. And you are just absolutely jaw on the ground, compelled moment to moment. You are in the room.
Yes, you are.
This has been redone for television. It's been redone as a feature film. It's been redone for stage. There's all this. Nothing will ever come close to the original 1957 feature film, 12 Angry Men. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
Technically speaking, the film is perfect.
Yeah.
What Lumet does with his camera and his lenses, it gets increasingly smaller, right? I mean, as the film progresses, you feel like how these characters probably feel.
Yeah. The film changes your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into this film and you see the facts and you're like, okay, I got it.
Right.
I know how I feel. And then slowly, over the course, juror by juror, you find out the truth. Not just the truth, but the questions underneath the truth. And just like, and you ask more and more questions. And then by the end of the film, you're like, my God, I thought I knew what I thought. I thought I knew who I was.
Yeah.
And I come to find out I didn't.
Right.
I didn't know that. I didn't know what I thought. I don't know who I am. I'm questioning everything. And it's going back to, you know, my number five pick, Capturing the Freedmans.
Yeah.
It's how committed am I really to the truth? How committed am I to making sure that I live in a world where truth is first and truth is foremost? And I have to admit, after I get done with 12 Angry Men, that I'm not as committed as I need to be. And it's just, it's a reinvigoration of that commitment. And just the fact that a film can do that.
I know.
It's one of the most timeless films I think has ever been made.
Now, are you trying to tell me that this knife really fell through a hole in the boy's pocket? Someone picked it up off the street, went to the boy's house, and stabbed his father with it just to test its sharpness?
No, I'm just saying it's possible the boy lost his knife and that somebody else stabbed his father with a similar knife. It's just possible.
Take a look at this knife. It's a very unusual knife. I've never seen one like it. Neither had the storekeeper who sold it to the boy. Aren't you asking us to accept a pretty incredible coincidence?
I'm just saying a coincidence is possible.
And I say it's not possible.
Where did that come from? It's the same knife.
What are you doing?
Where did you get it?
I bought that in a little pawn shop just two blocks from the boy's house. It cost $6.
It's against the law to buy or sell switchblade knives.
That's right, I broke the law.
But it actually makes you wonder, what are you willing to allow change your mind?
Yeah.
Is it facts? Is it time? Mm-hmm. Is it being someplace where you're actually forced to come to a conclusion? I mean, it is so good.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many questions that I remember having as a viewer that were totally dismantled by the end.
Right.
And I love that.
We're all the protagonists are in our own story. Mm-hmm. That's just the way human life and human ego works. You like to think that you're Henry Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
You like to think that you're the guy, you're the lone guy who's going to stand up for what's right. And what's so amazing about the film is it makes you confront the fact that you're not Henry Fonda. It makes me confront the fact that, oh my God,
right,
I'm Lee Cobb.
Yes.
And the fact that that a movie can reach into my body and shake my spine like that, without exception, every juror, the casting is so perfect. It just, everything about it works. I know I'm gushing at this point, but man, 12 Angry Men, watch the movie, change your mind, change your life. It's fantastic.
So my number three, which I already spoiled for you, is the 1996 freshman film of Wes Anderson, that's Bottle Rocket.
Bottle Rocket.
I mean, you know how I feel about this if you listen to episode 10, but there's very few films that I actually wish I would have made. And feel like, not feel like I could have made, but just think like, huh, there's so many things I share with this filmmaker in terms of sense of humor and style. I mean, there's so many things, right, that just seem like I connect with this person. Like, I want to do that. Like, that seems so, so incredible to have that effect, to have that feeling. And Wes Anderson, Bottle Rocket is one of those films.
Yeah.
I know it's not perfect, but it's damn near perfect for me, and so, so good.
It's a gem. It's a gem in the film world that it's just where you watch it and you're like, I haven't seen that film before. It's unique, and it's good that it's unique, but it's just the kind of thing that, like, that's something that you can do, and I don't think that I realized you could do a thing like that, and that's how great to discover that.
Yep, it would be on one of my favorite films of all time lists. So
it's a great choice.
Number two.
I was excited to talk about this one. We mentioned at the start of part one, you have great films, you have films that mean a lot to you, you have films that sort of grabbed hold of you at a certain point in life. My number two pick's a great film, but even more than that, it had life-altering properties to it. I can honestly say, and I want to mention this before I even say what the film is, because I watched my number two pick film, I sat down afterwards and I wrote my first screenplay.
Wow.
That story makes me want to tell a story.
Oh, man.
And that was an amazing moment. I think I mentioned up front George Clooney, the actor who decided that, you know, he would try his hand at directing. The same thing here. The director and the film that I'm talking about is the 1980 film by director Robert Redford. And the film is Ordinary People.
That almost made my list.
Yes.
Oh, my word. That film is so good.
That film is sublime.
It really is.
You can almost imagine Robert Redford behind the camera saying, I want this to be the things that I've always wanted to try, but I've never been able to in the films that I've actually starred in.
Right.
Screenplay, flawless. Performances, without peer. The discovery of Timothy Hutton in the lead role. But not just Timothy Hutton. And some of my favorite performances, not just by these actors, but of all time, from Mary Tyler Moore and the man, Donald Sutherland.
That guy in that film.
Oh, this is the story of a family in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the aftermath of a death in the family. They're trying to keep their masks on. They're trying to keep it together. They're trying to show that they are the strong people that can survive crisis and continue. But damn it, they can't, and they don't know what to do, and they're falling apart, and they're breaking. And just nugget by nugget, you get the backstory of what's probably happened, powerful line by powerful line. It's just, it's something that, you know, it can't be missed.
How long were you in the hospital?
4 months.
What did you do?
I tried to off myself. Isn't it down there? What do you know about me? Have you talked to Crawford?
Yes, he called me on the phone. Said you had a brother who died. Boating accident, wasn't it? You want to tell me about it?
Well, I suppose you talked this over with Crawford at the hospital, right?
Right.
Good. How'd that go?
Didn't change anything.
What'd you want to change?
I told you I'd like to be more in control.
Well, I'll tell you something. I'm not big on control. But it's your money.
How's Tuesdays and Fridays? Same time.
Twice a week.
Wow. Control's a tough nut.
I love that film for how haunted it is. The most important thing in each of these characters' lives is the thing they're not willing to address.
Right.
So then you have, and you have Timothy Hutton really in relationship with Elizabeth McGovern, and the way that he begins to just get a sense of himself or what's going on or just starting to deal with some of these things is beautiful. And the one thing that they need, like you said, they're not able to do, which is be together, like to connect, to come and to share in each other's lives and sorrow and grief.
There's so many moments from the film that just they stay with you. And I don't know, I could pick any number of them, but when Timothy Hutton is talking to Judd Hirsch, you see a metamorphosis happen where Judd Hirsch becomes Timothy Hutton's brother. It's no longer talking about his brother. He begins talking to his brother because he's talking about the death of his brother, about how they died when they were out on the open water. And he's saying to his brother, and he admits that he hates his brother for dying, for not surviving, for not hanging on to the raft. How could you do that? That was a powerful moment. Profound truths all through the movie. Yeah. And like I said, I could talk about it all night. But
so human. This is human.
Yeah. Ordinary People, just one of the greatest films, one of my favorite films ever.
So my number two pick, we talked about this film before, and I told you, I said, I don't know if this is going to make the list, because what if we talk about it in the future? And you said, just put it on, if it should be on there, put it on there.
Yeah, sure.
And then once it was on there, it couldn't go anywhere else.
Yeah.
I knew it had to be high. And so my number two pick is the 1999 freshman film of Spike Jonze, Being John Malkovich.
Yes.
So this film, when I saw it, I remember thinking, you can do this?
Right.
You can tell these types of stories about these people finding a portal into the head of John Malkovich.
Right. Of all people.
Of all people. And it's not someone playing John Malkovich, but it's actually John Malkovich playing John Malkovich.
Yeah. Like,
but then it feels so real.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about that film and why it's one of my favorite films ever, is because of the absurdity matched with this really realistic style of filmmaking.
I'm sorry to have called you like that, but I was just really, really scared. And I was so freaked out. I mean, it was like somebody was just moving all the way through me, moving my arms, moving my hands, talking for me. I mean, I feel like I'm going crazy, Charlie.
I'm sure you're not going crazy.
You don't understand, man. It's like nothing I've ever felt.
Yeah, yada, yada, yada. Were you stoned?
Yes. Yes, sir. Jesus. Yes. Yes, I was stoned. But that doesn't have anything to do with it. Charlie, someone was talking through my mouth.
You were stoned. Case closed. End of story.
The things that Charlie Kaufman does with that script, the questions that he's asking in terms of what does it mean to be a person? What is a person? Right. What does it mean to be you? Who else can be you?
Right.
And what is identity? And what is love? And do you need to be someone else to love another person? Or for someone to love you, is that really love? Where at the end of it, I'd find myself really questioning the type of person that I am, and that I also project. I love the triangulation between Craig, played by John Cusack, Lottie, played by Cameron Diaz, Catherine Keener's character, Maxine, maybe. Really, Lottie and Craig are vying for the attention of Maxine, and just the sorrow and the heartbreak Craig goes through realizing that this woman, Maxine, not his wife, but someone he's in love with, doesn't love him back, but actually loves his wife instead.
Yeah.
But only through the form of John Malkovich.
Right.
I mean, it's just so crazy. And
yeah.
It's such an unbelievable film, and it gets to my heart in such a weird way.
Yeah. If it had not been Spike Jonze, it wouldn't have been. And if it hadn't been Charlie Kaufman, it wouldn't have been. It was this marriage of perfection. Adaptation is also one of my favorite films.
Right.
You see a similar level of brilliance there. It's just, yeah. I love that team. I don't know that they can do any wrong.
One of the best things I've ever listened to on writing in general, and it was screenwriting specifically, Charlie Kaufman's lecture that he gave at BAFTA. But his desire for wanting to create human stories, and it comes across in that lecture, is so beautiful. And it makes me love him so much. Of what his project and actually wanting to tell stories is something I resonate deeply with. And so it makes sense to me in my connections to his scripts and the films that are made.
Yeah.
From them, so.
I suspected / knew this would be on your list. thrilled to see it that high, a film that people need to see. I like the fact that we've got multiple Charlie Kaufman representation here on this list. That's fantastic.
It is.
Yeah.
So here it is.
Here we are. So Daniel, my number one pick, I mentioned number 10 was my hardest to figure out. My number one pick, on the other hand, took no effort at all. Right. There was no question from the beginning, because my favorite film of all time, just by happenstance, is a Freshman film.
Lucky bastard.
I know. It just kind of worked out that way. It's been my favorite film since I was a teenager. So this is for over 20 years now. The film that I base my life on. And I realize that that's a relationship that most people don't have with film, but I do. It's a film that's changed and informed the decisions of my life. It's the reason that I'm married to the woman I'm married to. I could go on and on and on. The Freshman film of director John Patrick Shanley is the 1990 film, my number one pick, my favorite film of all time, and that's Joe versus the Volcano. Now, you may laugh. And many do, because many think that this is not a serious pick. Like, this is the sort of funny, quirky thing that a guy like me says. But no.
This is it. This is yours.
This is my absolute favorite film of all time. And, you know, I could say that may change. I don't see it happening, though. Because a film that is that deeply in your person and in your soul, and this identification that you have this closely with a character, and I'm talking about the character of Joe Banks,
right,
played by Tom Hanks. I am Joe Banks. And I can say that with full confidence. I've been Joe Banks for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. Everything that happens in this movie, I can't say it's my story, but it's the story I want it to be my story. Right. And I've tried to live my life in such a way so that it is that. So just in terms of as fast as I can premise, it concerns a man named Joe who is in a very lousy job, and he finds out that he has a terminal illness, and he is coincidentally offered the chance to live out the rest of his days as a grand, terrific adventure. But of course, the catch is the people that are offering him this grand adventure tell him that at the end of it, he has to agree to jump into a volcano. And so, of course, he agrees. And the film follows Joe through joys and through tribulations and through meetings of all these different people that happen to all look like Meg Ryan. Of course, it culminates in his decision whether or not he's actually going to take the leap into the volcano at the end of the film and what the consequences of that are. So I could go on for a full episode. I could go on for 3 episodes about Joe versus the Volcano. I'll resist. But Daniel, you know my affection for this film.
I know it. And I'd like to share that the last time I saw this film was in Long Beach at the Art Theater for your 40th birthday.
That's right.
Because you have an incredible wife.
Incredible wife.
Who decided, you know what, for your 40th, I'm going to throw a surprise party for Jeremy. I'm going to invite all of his friends, and we're going to run out this theater, and we're going to watch his favorite film of all time.
It's true. And yes, I can confirm somehow it happened. I didn't do anything to deserve this, but I somehow landed the greatest wife in the world. And what Daniel said is true. She rented out this theater. She threw a Joe versus the Volcano themed party at the Art Theater at Long Beach, which is a beautiful theater, by the way. Of course, you know, before the film started, because I'm that kind of guy, I gave a speech about my affection for the film, and we all watched. And Daniel, you were in attendance,
and
I really appreciate it.
There's a part in the movie where Joe says to Meg Ryan's character, if you have the choice between killing yourself and doing the thing that you're scared of doing, why not take the leap and do the thing that you're scared of doing? And it sounds a little strange, but that moment in that movie absolutely changed the whole course of my life. And I like to think that the reason that I live in California and I'm married to the most beautiful girl in the world and that I do the things that I like and that I'm good at for a living is because someone said to me via a movie screen, why not take the leap and do the thing that you're scared of doing? So it's a comedy and it's fun and all these kinds of things, but It's probably the best expression of me and who I am that I can possibly. If you haven't seen Joe versus the Volcano yet, I envy you so much. Because, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you.
I have actually original storyboard artwork from the film.
That's amazing.
I've been part of so many different groups and message boards and all that. There is a small number of committed Joe heads in the world.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah, I don't know what we're called, but it's a cult classic. It's the biggest heart that you'll ever see in a movie, in my opinion.
It's good. And I think every copy of Joe versus the Volcano should come with a video of you endorsing it and describing why it matters so much. I've had new affection for it as a result of knowing how it connects to your story and why.
Thank you.
It's so important to you. And thinking about John Patrick Shanley, I mean, Doubt is one of my favorite films.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. By the way, the only other film that he directed.
I know, and that's crazy to me. Yeah. He was a playwright.
He's, and still primarily known as a playwright. And so a very successful playwright. And he decided to try his hand at screenwriting. You know, some very interesting screenplays. Early in his screenwriting career, won an Oscar for his screenplay for the film Moonstruck.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful screenplay. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's great film. Norman Jewison, great director, really the strength of that film. If you ever listen to the commentary track of Moonstruck, you'll hear Norman Jewison saying, "Nothing about the quality of this film has anything to do with me. It's John Patrick Shanley."
Wow.
And if you ever had the chance to attend a John Patrick Shanley play, it's an experience you won't forget.
Wow.
He has a style, you know, I know we've talked about Wes Anderson, Coen Brothers, P.T. Anderson, just these guys that, you know, you can three lines in, you're like, okay, that's got to be a script by then. John Patrick Shanley, I know his lines and his dialogue so well that it's his voice is the voice.
You can tell.
I just like, he's easily, you know, my writer of choice, but he's Joe versus the Volcano. It's my favorite. So, Daniel, as much as I enjoy talking about Joe versus the Volcano, I've been looking forward even more to hearing your number one pick. I've thought about it a lot this week. What is it going to be? My mind has been spinning and spinning around. I've got thoughts, I've got ideas, but nothing really substantial that I can hang on to. So I've been waiting for this for a while.
Okay, well, I can almost guarantee that you wouldn't guess it. My number one pick, also by a playwright who decided to become a director. Also has made very few films, only three. And this is the 2000 film by Kenneth Lonergan called You Can Count on Me.
Wow.
This is my number one favorite freshman film.
Wow. Tell me about this movie. I have not seen this movie.
This is one of those films that I can't detach from my time in life. It's a story about a brother and sister. Sammy is actually the sister and Terry's the brother. Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo. They're a brother and sister whose parents died when they were young. Their relationship has been a little bit tenuous, and he's kind of been off somewhere, and he comes back, but ends up sticking around. The reason why this is my favorite freshman film is because it has everything in it that I love about stories. Now, I wouldn't even necessarily say it has everything in it I love about film, but when it comes to stories, this film is so powerful to me,
yeah.
And it's so human. And it's so quiet at its core, partly because here are two people dealing with this grief that they haven't outgrown. But in many ways, they maybe should have.
Yeah.
But the older sister still playing the older sister, and the younger brother still playing the younger brother.
Sure.
When I saw this film, it was in a period of life in which I was with loved ones who we'd all lost someone pretty like close to us. And,
right.
And it just did something to me.
Right.
It showed me the power that I think grief has over people for a long time, but it also shows the power that people have together. And the thing I appreciate about Kenneth Lonergan and his films, the point is not even what he's doing with his camera, but it's about people. And
yeah.
It's about Mark Ruffalo as this character who's an adult but is still a child. And there's this moment when he's come to stay for a little bit, but you think he's going to leave, and then he finds out a friend where he came from died. And he's putting on his shoes, and you just don't see it coming. And I get emotional talking about it. And Sammy comes in, and he's putting on his shoes to do something, and she says, "I think you should stay a while." And it's this two-second thing where he starts to almost whimper and cry like a kid, and he says, "I think that's a good idea." That's not a cry I've actually ever seen necessarily in film before. This isn't sadness.
Yeah.
This isn't anger.
Yeah.
This is childlike. This is something he's needed to do for a long time, but probably hasn't. And you see Laura Linney's character so focused on getting Terry's life together when her life is a total mess.
Yeah.
There's so many elements about this film that I can resonate with and connect with. Just couldn't think of another film that deserved the top spot because it represents all these things I love about storytelling.
Yeah, it's interesting. So and again, I have not seen this movie. I mean, clearly this is something that I need to see immediately. And so grief, it sounds like, is central.
That's a central theme.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that. Like, if I thought about the themes throughout my films, there's something about feeling in terms of all of them. Like, I kind of feel my way into the world. I feel like that's kind of how I live. And so stories, I kind of want to think about them based upon what did they evoke in me.
Yeah.
Like, and we've talked about this. I don't come at films like in a craft way. A film moves me and then I try to make sense of it.
Right.
And this was a film that was deeply affecting for me in that way.
I don't think you know how to behave around an 8-year-old, and I don't know how to make you stop, so I don't think you should live here. I don't know what else to say.
I don't know how to behave around an 8-year-old.
That's right.
I think you don't know how to behave around an 8-year-old.
Are you out of your mind? Now, just listen to me. No, I may not be the greatest mother in the world, but I'm doing the best I know how, and he doesn't need you to rub his face in shit because you think it's good for him. He's gonna find out the world is a horrible place and that people suck soon enough and without any help from you. Believe me.
There are movies that I'll fully admit that I have avoided because I know that's gonna be sore to find a film, and there are a few out there that just pluck that nerve in such a way that it just it hurts and you're grateful for the hurt. Sometimes it's a film, or sometimes it's a book, or sometimes it's a poem, or you know, something. Sometimes it's a drawing. It grabs back at that again. And when that happens, you have this pain and you hate the pain, but you're grateful for that reminder of that pain. And I don't know. There's nothing more human than that, but I don't know how else to describe it. It sounds like some of that is what we're getting at with that film.
Absolutely. And grief is like the stream that is flowing underneath that film, but it's not ever necessarily addressed, like in the sense of, well, this is what we're sad about, and so this is what we need to deal with. You just know at the very beginning, something happens. You see how they're struggling through it and dealing with the grief by how they interact with everything else.
Yeah.
Which I think is a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing. Well, let me just say that I'm newly inspired, newly emboldened to see films, not just that I've never seen before that are some of the picks that you mentioned on your list, but also to revisit films that I already know are good and they deserve a second look, a third look, many, many looks, because needless to say, there's not one film on this list that isn't of just fantastic quality. I'm glad we did this.
I'm glad we did this too. And I love how personal it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember telling my wife just very early on, if you want to know me, watch this movie, you know,
right.
Which is a strange thing to say, but that's the power of film. And I think I speak for both of us when I say that's why we're so committed to this thing of talking about film and looking at it and really digging into it, because it's worth doing. It's art, yeah, but it's life. It's the heartbeat, the 24 frames a second capturing what it is to be a human being. And that's, you know, whether it's screwball or whether that's powerful and tearjerker, whatever it is, that's important. That's worth preserving.
Yep. I mean, I continually think of a quote by Joan Didion who says, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live. We watch stories.
Yeah.
Think about stories in order to live. I mean, in order to live well, right? A film can actually affect the choices you make in life.
Yeah.
That a film might actually impact the way that I can be with myself or someone else who's been affected deeply by loss.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty freaking crazy thing.
It really is. And before we go, I think it's worth just maybe just one final time giving the final run through for those that maybe decided to skip to the end. You shouldn't have done that, but nevertheless, we'll reward it. So of course, and this is Jeremy speaking, my top 10 freshman films. Number 10, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind by George Clooney. Number 9, Pieces of April by Peter Hedges. Number 8, Blood Simple, the Coen Brothers. Number 7, Swingers by Doug Liman. Number 6, Citizen Kane by Orson Welles. Number 5, Capturing the Friedmans, Andrew Jarecki. Number 4, Bottle Rocket by Wes Anderson. Number 3, 12 Angry Men by Sidney Lumet. Number 2, Ordinary People by Robert Redford. And of course, number 1, Joe versus the Volcano John Patrick Shanley.
My 10 are Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino. Number 9, George Washington by David Gordon Green. Number 8, The 400 Blows by Francois Truffaut. Number 7, Blood Simple by the Coen Brothers. Number 6, Say Anything by Cameron Crowe. Number 5, Gates of Heaven by Errol Morris. Number 4, Badlands by Terrence Malick. Number 3, Bottle Rocket by Wes Anderson. Number 2, Being John Malkovich by Spike Jonze. Number 1, You Can Count on Me by Kenneth Lonergan.
We want to thank you once again for joining us for this very special two-parter, the top 10 freshman films of all time, as decided by myself, Jeremy Baer, and my partner, Daniel Long. We'd love to hear list. What do you think? Tell us where we're wrong or even wonderfully right. We want to know your opinions. And if there's something on our list that's conspicuously missing, we'd like to know what it is and why it is. And so please write us.
I mean, we know what we're talking about. And my list won't change, but I still want to hear your opinions on why I'm wrong, and then I can tell you why you were wrong.
We'd like to thank our listeners. We'd like to thank everyone who's taken the time to listen to the list and who's willing to contribute one of their own in particular. But most of all, as we head out of 2016 and into 2017, we'd like to thank you for taking the journey with us. It's been terrific fun doing this podcast.
Yes.
We're really looking forward to our final 4 episodes of our 15 films.
Thank you so much for listening.
It means a lot to us, genuinely. Please continue to do so.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Bye.